This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahman. Welcome to Night School, the show that explores key themes in history, the social sciences, and the humanities. Together with Shorat Kutan, we critically unpack theories, frameworks, and social phenomena the better to understand how society works. Each week, we discuss a classic text, theme, or an idea that we hope to shed light on the world around you. Shorat can't make it this week, but we are joined by Yvonne Fu. She is a psychologist with the Lighthouse Psychological Wellbeing Center, but she also lectures at the psychology department at HELP University. And she's here to talk to us about existential psychotherapy. Welcome to the show, Yvonne.
Thank you, Fuad. Thank you.
So I guess for our show, I mean, we have a lot of psychologists come to the station, but they tend to be more practical. They address hands-on everyday life issues. But I guess for us, given the kinds of things we talk about, we're more interested in the existential part of things and how that blends in with psychology and psychotherapy in general. So let's start with that then. What's the connection between the existentialism and psychotherapy or psychology more broadly?
Well, you know, existential or existentialism, it actually has a very, very strong root in philosophy. And existential psychotherapy actually is like a hybrid between philosophy and psychology. And when you say how does it fit into this whole psychotherapy thing, it's really a way or an approach to psychotherapy that looks into the existential pain of a person in this world. It's probably one of the depth psychology or depth psychotherapy that looks into how our existence in this world at itself, with all these givens and life, you know, death and meaninglessness, and so all these things is kind of contributing to what we call, you know, psychopathology or madness. Mm-hmm. So that's how it, you know, I see it fits into this psychotherapy.
Now, how would you locate it more broadly in psychology in Malaysia, right? Because I personally, based on the little I know, don't encounter existential practice in psychology as much. And from what I also gather, there's a heavy scientific and neurological inclination in psychology more broadly, right? So what does existentialism add to psychology that maybe those other more dominant strands don't recognize?
Well, you know, what, not only in Malaysia, even in the West, like one of my friends in the States, he said that he's like one of those snow leopards in a university where people look at him like, you know, that is that existential guy, that, you know, like, we know that they exist, but we don't quite know what they are, kind of thing. I think in Malaysia context, existential psychology or, you know, psychotherapy, whichever you call it, is really relatively new. But I also see the need for it, and people kind of slowly recognizing the need for it as well. I kind of lost your question, but
so I mean, like, why not just like, okay, have a few sessions, maybe two or three, you identify the symptoms, then you have a checklist, right?
Yeah, that's true.
Are you sleeping well? Are you eating well?
That's usually what we do.
Yeah. So why do we need existentialism?
Exactly. You know, when I first came into clinical psychology, you know, I recognized that the what called dominating approach, the way to psychotherapy, a lot of people would do things like CBT, or probably that's the major approach. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing wrong with that, you know. We look at thoughts or emotion or behavior. But I also feel that there's something more to that besides the way that we think, the way that we feel. The way existential psychology resonates with me is that, and even more right now as I'm in the practice, is that I realize that a lot of things cannot just be addressed by changing the thoughts or changing the behavior. And I feel that in my own experience, the way that a person would approach life, meaning the attitude towards suffering, all these things, and the underlying theme of the fear of death and fear of isolation, fear of meaninglessness, and all these things which are the core theme of existential psychology, is very apparent. Just people don't talk about it much because, you know, how our society is, like when you say, you know, oh, I wonder what's my meaning in life, and people go like, ah, come on, you have got nothing better to do, just, you know, go do your work. We dismiss those kind of questions. So growing up, it's kind of like, we don't ask those questions anymore. it is still there. It's just like a nagging thing at the back of our mind.
Yeah.
A divorce, a loss of someone in your life, all these things could actually trigger all these bigger questions.
Yeah.
That I think has somehow been kind of like overlooked in a lot of areas in psychology.
So this brings me to, I guess, the common theme in what you're explaining here, which is the pain of existence itself, right? So existentialism recognizes that, granted, you have life issues, right? Like bills to pay, social issues that you have to confront given your identity. But, you know, that aside, there's also the more underlying fact that, you know, you exist confronting questions you can't answer, injustices you can't address. And this swells up, you know, psychologically, emotionally over the years into existential dread, angst, you know, the fact that, you know, we're here and one day we're not going to be here. And so how do we find meaning in that? And existentialism is the discourse that, you know, explores the many dimensions of that conundrum, right? And but what I'm wondering, I guess, is that as a philosopher, and existential is one of the words I use all the time alongside, you know, I don't know, communism, French toast and octopus or something like part of my vocabulary. But what does psychology offer to cure that? You know, because part of the philosophical approach is that, you know, I guess we read, we have certain options or the way to look at the world, right? Yeah. We don't think of it as a cure or treatment. So it seems to me, sounds like psychology is offering a cure for existential, or not a cure, but a treatment for existential dread. So what does the intervention look like from the psychologist's perspective? Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's the question. I mean, a lot of times when I do my lectures on existential psychotherapy, one of the questions they would ask is, so what are the techniques that we use in treating or curing this, you know, whether it's existential vacuum or existential dread, whatever it is? But the good news and the bad news is there's really no cure to it. You see, what we're trying to say is, and the way that I'm coming from is that in the session, at least, it is a space where people are finally allowed to explore deeper all these things, all these questions, all these, like you say, angst and the struggles that they face in their life. Whether it's just simply asking, what's the meaning of my life? We may not have the answer, but just be allowed, just having the permission to ask that question, I think, is the first step to it. Because a lot of times we are not even given that space to explore that. And the role of the therapist is being there with them, going through this journey of maybe looking for the answer, if there's an answer, or, you know, bearing witness sometimes to the suffering that they're going through, even though there may not be any answer at this point in time. For me, it is a very sacred space where the therapist and the client are both on a journey where you just try to sit with that, you know, whether it's angst or pain or dread, and see maybe something might come out of it.
Now, this is all very interesting to me, again, because of where I'm coming from and what you're suggesting, it seems, is that, you know, rather than wallowing in these questions alone, which can tend to happen when you read a lot of philosophy, right? You're just discussing with the text and you sense even more isolation as a result, because not everybody's thinking about these things. But how is what you just described different from what you would do from what you would do with a friend, right? Because you could just look up on Facebook, find an existential book club, and then find other people you can talk about this with. It seems to me that that is something that that approach can offer too. So what more does the clinical practice add to that, then, rather than just being a conversation about life?
I guess that answer could apply to similarly other situations as well. Like, why look for a counselor or a clinical psychologist if you have a friend who can, you know, discuss with you about your issues and life struggles, or, you know, give solutions. And that's fine if you have friends who can do that with you, and, you know, we encourage that. But I mean, a lot of people might not have that options. Some of the people who come to me, they might have, you know, so-called clinical disorders like OCDs and depression, and they just don't find anyone who can understand the situation. And for us, I mean, a clinical psychologist, well, it depends on which approach that you're coming from, but from an existential approach, we don't really kind of emphasize on the psychopathology part of it. And for me, even the most bizarre or abnormal kind of symptoms, when you look at the person's whole context, whole life, you know, where he's coming from, his childhood or whatever, it somehow could make sense, you know. I really like this quote, actually. I can't remember the whole thing, but I kind of just jot it down. It says, "When life itself seems lunatic, who knows where madness lies? Now, perhaps to be too practical is madness. To surrender dreams, this may be madness. To seek treasure when there is only trash, too much sanity may be madness. And maddest of all is to see life as it is and not as it should be." And I think that really beautifully captured...
Who's that by the way?
I think it's from a Broadway play called The Man of La Mancha.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that really captures beautifully the idea of how I and, you know, many of my existential psychologist friend see psychopathology. And when you really enter the world, you will see that what we seem to know as madness or abnormal really has its place in this person's life.
Where does treatment come into it, though? Because, mm-hmm. you know, people with chronic symptoms,
right,
might want, in this case, more measurable solutions, right, with clear metrics,
okay.
right? And while, you know, all these things, I agree with you, I concur with you, are important, but people who actually have, you know, clinical insomnia, I mean, all these things that really disrupt their functioning, do existential questions become secondary in that case, or is it still relevant? I mean, so my question is, is this a one-size-fits-all worldview?
Right.
Or do you reserve this only for cases which are less chronic?
Right, right. I mean, that's a really good question for it, because to give an example, if let's say a person were to come in with clinical insomnia or OCDs, you know, of course we wouldn't just go like, okay, so what is your meaning in life? You know, what do you fear death? These are very, very in the cloud philosophical kind of questions. And I think a lot of times people think that, oh, you know, existential psychotherapy is very abstract, but actually it is also a very grounded approach to psychotherapy as well. Grounded because we might talk about philosophical questions, but that's not what we are mainly interested in. We talk about your daily life in its most concrete terms, and the themes that arise out of these things that we talk about, then we can look into them and how these themes are affecting your life. And that's where we go about it. And to give you a very maybe good example, I do have clients with OCDs, and somehow I got a few of these clients, and one of the clients always, OCD with OCD obsessions and compulsions. And one of the things that he always does is, so his compulsions is always on checking stuff, washing and stuff like that. So for me, when I look at him and we talk about all the themes that arise out of his anxiety, it's a lot of anxiety about how the limitations of life. What if I make one mistake and my life ends? What if I make one mistake and my relationship ends? And all this, when you look at it, it's very, very much embedded in our own existence, our fear of this limitation in life. So as we talk about it, as we sit with this anxiety, somehow we also address the symptoms as well. Now, so do we wait until we address those themes to address those symptoms? Not necessarily. Sometimes we might still, talk about some activities that can do, can try out. Maybe like say for depression, they can still, carry out some exercises at home. What I'm saying is that I look at it as a balance, to also look at some of these underlying themes.
So it's a good standpoint to have, right? Because you don't want to reduce all symptoms to be about existential questions. But having that perspective, it seems to me, as you're having the conversation about the person, his relationship with control, right? How much of life can you control? And why does control matter, right? It's because you've internalized this idea of life as something that can be controlled, right? When a lot of things are really out of your hands. And then it seems to me, at least, I've been to therapy a few times, so I'm trying to picture what this might be like. The conversation would add that dimension, right? death, mortality, finitude, and all that.
Mm-hmm.
But let's take a pause for now. We've been signaled for a break, and we'll be right back after these messages with Yvonne Fu. She is a lecturer in psychology at Hull University and also practices at the Lighthouse Psychological Wellbeing Center, and she's here to talk about existential psychotherapy with me, Ahmad Fuad Rahman, and this is Night School on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, you're listening to me, Ahmad Fuad Rahmat. We are joined by Yvonne Fu of Help University and the Lighthouse Psychological Wellbeing Center to talk about existential psychotherapy. In the first part of the show, we had an overview of what it's about, how it fits into psychology and the clinical setting more specifically. And the second part, I guess I would like to probe more about two things. The first is its intellectual foundations, right? So I'm curious now as to who the philosophers you consult for the process, because the discourse is very different,
mm-hmm.
right? So if you read something by Heidegger,
mm-hmm.
and say if you read something in psychology, typically these days books are written by MDs, right? If you mm-hmm. look at studies of trauma and stuff like that, you have to turn to very medicalized discourses. So one name comes to mind is Viktor Frankl.
Yeah.
Yeah. But maybe there are others. So what was the intellectual genesis to this project?
I think a lot of people, one of the first entry into existential psychology as one of those people are Viktor Frankl, like what you just mentioned. Mm-hmm. The other one is Irvin Yalom, mm-hmm. Rollo May. So these are a few of the so-called modern existential psychologists who have written widely about this topic. So for myself, one of my first encounters with this topic is Viktor Frankl,
mm-hmm.
and then Irvin Yalom.
Yeah.
So even among the people who, you know, study existential psychology, it's actually a very, very wide area, and there are even, you know, probably different views on what it is really about, you know, among these existential psychologists. I was just having conversations with my friend. He's one of the professors of existential psychology in the States, and he said that, you know, there are so many different sort of branches in existential psychology. You have, for example, existential phenomenology,
mm-hmm.
existential psychoanalysis, mm-hmm. existential humanistic,
mm-hmm.
Dasein analysis. Mm-hmm. So each of these, actually, they have sort of slightly different view on existential psychology.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say, at least in Malaysia, most of the people would first encounter would be probably Yalom and Frankl.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So Frankl wrote Man's Quest for Meaning, is it?
Yeah,
is that
Man's
the text?
Search for Meaning.
Man's
yeah.
Search for Meaning. And Yalom wrote
Existential Psychotherapy.
Okay, so yeah. Does the question of context matters at all? You know, Malaysians mm-hmm. tend to be very religious, and they turn
yeah.
to religion for existential answers, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, regardless if you're Malay or Chinese, people tend to hold on to a certain worldview where some divine or spirituality is evoked, right? So does that present any challenges for you as a therapist to bring a more humanistic, quote-unquote, element to existential questions?
Because of the multicultural perspective.
Oh, but also the more religious mm-hmm. inclinations that Malaysians have. You know, because mm-hmm. part of my challenge when I teach philosophy is for them not to denounce their religion or whatever, but to just think, all right, this is an alternative explanation,
right?
That answers the same questions differently.
Right.
And you should consider that to its full extent before you revert to your normal way of thinking, right?
Okay.
So, yeah, so they would rather think, well, why am I here? Well, the scripture says this,
okay.
right? The pastor says that,
okay.
right? So I don't really have to think about what Sartre might say,
right? That's true.
So where, you know, you have a lot of, I guess, the more atheistic side of existentialism is quite, mm-hmm. not bleak, I wouldn't say so, but people who are unacquainted will see it as frightening, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
And I think that's probably one of the misconceptions about existential psychotherapy or psychology is that it's probably quite atheistic,
mm-hmm.
Which it's not necessarily is. And so there are some existential psychologists who are more on the atheist side of the spectrum. But in the sessions itself, as clinical psychologist, it's not really my intention to impose on to the clients on, you know, these views and whether or not God exists, to enter into a debate or something like that. So for me, it's more like, okay, if you want to talk about life and death from the perspective of Christianity, then let's talk about it and let me learn about it. You know, maybe tell me what you think, because believe it or not, I've encounter people, even if they are Christians, they have very different way of thinking about what life and death is like. So one of the things I've learned is not to make assumptions that because you are from this religion or that religion, you would have this certain set of thinking. So let's talk about it. And actually, that really helps, because when they are with their own religion group, sometimes I feel like I can't question, I can't talk about these things because people would think that I'm, you know, not being faithful or things like that. So in that space, it allows them to talk about it, some of the doubts, you know, some of the questions.
Yeah, that's interesting though, because based on what I gather, the therapist in this case is quite elastic in your standpoint, right? In the sense that you don't have the answers coming in, and you said that you want to learn, you might be wrong, and you're trying to understand the person, and this is a different register or attitude towards, again, the treatment than, say, I would assume most clinicians adopt, right? Because you sound like an interlocutor, right, of sorts, rather than someone with the answers or a doctor who has the cure to just, you know, dish out. You know, so my question then is, how would you characterize the uniqueness of the existential clinician as opposed to any other clinician? Like, you know, how's your practice different given your existential training than, say, somebody without an existential training as a therapist? Yeah.
Right. I think in terms of doing therapy, rather than saying that, you know, I do existential therapy, I think it's more about the existential attitude in the sessions. Like I said, even among the existential psychotherapists, there are different views on how to go about it. But I personally really agree with one of the very good friends. He was here last year for the first, you know, existential humanistic conference in Malaysia. So his name is Todd, and he talks about how therapy, you know, not looking at it as something like a correction deficit model, like you injure your knee, so we come and we treat it, we, you know, maybe treat the wound or things like that, or fix it, cure it like a surgeon. But as a therapist, at least from his point of view, it's more about attending, questioning, you know, allow the person to go and wonder and at least explore, discover. He called it a weak therapy, you know, rather than a strong therapy. But the weak therapy doesn't mean that it's less of a therapy, but that it is something that allows the person to, well, to use a very cliche term, grow out of his own pain, rather than we going in and saying, no, this is wrong, you have to correct this and that. So I think that's how I approach therapy from an existential point of view. And when I say existential attitude, it's really how I relate to client in the session. I think existential attitude or existential psychology is not a reductionistic approach. So we actually acknowledge that, you know, cognitive, emotions, behavior, even unconscious, all these things are very, very important. So existential therapy actually do use techniques from various approaches. You know, use empty chair from Gestalt, you use sometimes homework borrowing from CBT, but it's the attitude that one has in the session with the client to be willing to look into all these, you know, underlying deeper themes in life. I think that what makes it slightly different. So one may not even call himself an existential therapist, and I don't call myself that as well.
Right.
But one could be very existential in the way that he approaches therapy sessions.
Right.
And even if it's a family therapist, it's a psychodynamic therapist.
Yeah. So because there are two interesting parallel arguments here, in the sense that one, there is a life beyond the symptom, an existence, like a human narrative behind the symptom, right? Mm-hmm. And thereby, the existential attitude would welcome a more expansive view of this person, right? Rather than just, you know, the repeated encounters with these, with his stumbling blocks, right? And that makes it a richer therapeutic process. I guess the parallel implication for that would be, what then is the cure? At what point does therapy end? Because a lot of these questions about existence can't be answered, right?
Yeah.
So when do you say, okay, time's up? As in, time's up, not just for the session, but I think you're all right, you know? Where does that happen? Or rather when, yeah.
Yeah, I think that is probably one of the most common critique of existential-based therapy. It's like, where does it end? You know, we'll never stop questioning, and there will always be, and we believe that there will always be anxiety. You know, the only time that we don't feel anxious is probably when we're 6 feet under. Mm-hmm. Well, there are some therapies that could go on for years. And Irvin Yalom, in his book, he has got clients who's been with him for, I think, 40 years or so, mm-hmm. but not like continuously, you know, on and off. She sees him she went and see him for therapy. But where does it end? It really depends on the mutual agreement between the therapist and the client. So maybe up to one point, let's say the client I do have clients with OCD symptoms, for example, and up to one point they feel like, okay, I think I can manage right now my symptoms, and I'm feeling more comfortable maybe, you know, handling my anxiety. I know now how to sit with it. I know now that these are some of the things that really concerns and bothers me, and I think I'm okay to, you know, look into these things on my own. So then I say, okay, maybe we can stop the session and maybe just reduce it to once in 1 month, 2 months. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So that happens. Mm. Or they are sometimes clients who just come and follow up like once in 2 months just to have continuous conversations about these things. Mm-hmm. So I think it's really up to the client's needs as well. Mm-hmm. But I would say, you know, at no point do we say that, oh, because this is, you know, life issue, let's continue on the sessions forever.
Yeah. How about responsibility though? I mean, to the extent that anxiety confronts possibilities, right? You're anxious largely mm-hmm. because there is option 1, 2, 3, and 4, and one must decide based on one's most authentic understanding mm-hmm. of oneself, right? Mm-hmm. And sometimes, and this is what I gather from therapists I've spoken to, you know, it's not an easy job in a lot of ways because you encounter people with difficulties, right? And yeah. it's a very, very intense exchange sometimes.
It is.
And you would see, given your training and your standpoint, things that they should do, right? And things that they should account for.
Yeah.
In which case, your option might be to say, the answer sometimes is there. Not everything's a mystery. Right, so which can sound tempting given the things you describe about the existential attitude, right? That because there's this elasticity of viewpoints that you can take in regards to how you face life. But when do you say, all right, the problem you know, the answer also you know, and I as a therapist, I'm going to draw a black and white line, right? Okay. Do you exercise that quote-unquote authority, and when, if so?
Okay. I think personally, I really respect the subjective view of the clients, even the subjective experience of them. I mean, what you just mentioned has actually occurred, you know, they'll be like, I'm sure there's an answer out there, you know, you just somebody just hasn't found it, you know. And responsibility is also one of the main concerns of, one of the main themes of existential psychology as well, that, well, we have freedom to do what we want to do, but we also have to be responsible for it. And similarly, in the sessions, we hold that responsibility of the clients very seriously as well. So this is a session I by no means should make decisions for you or right. answer for you, but we can look into this together. And if the clients at no point say that, no, I don't think this is working for me, or refuse to take the responsibility for their own life, for their own answer, then, well, I think sometimes confrontation may even be necessary for, you know, from my point of view, to say, you know, I kind of feel like we're not going anywhere. I kind of feel kind of stuck here. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure where we're going. And I kind of feel like sometimes it seems like you don't want to make a decision in this area. So maybe I might bring that up as well, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. instead of saying that, you know, I'm a therapist, I think this is what you should do.
Yeah.
I think that really takes away the autonomy of the client.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Last question before we wrap up. I mean, I have a lot more, but I guess for this show, you know, the responsibility is to end in yeah. a certain limit. Yeah. But I'm wondering too, nowadays, it seems to me that mental health awareness is seeing a certain growth, I feel, socially, you know, largely maybe through social media, people are sharing links about like the other day, 10 things you shouldn't say to somebody with depression, right? And people are sharing it. And people are saying, oh, I'm being more aware now. I shouldn't say this, blah, blah, blah. And then I think, is it this month that's Mental Health Awareness Month or something like that?
Yeah,
I think there's that like CBT Awareness Month or something like that. You know, there's always a discourse around greater mental health awareness. But I guess my own bias to that is that being a cultural studies educator, I always see our problems as socially linked, right? Not having power at work, which is key, right? Not having control over our economic conditions, right? Because we're so subject to a very merciless, competitive, you know, capitalist-driven world, right? And we're just one pawn in it. And this is the kind of things that alienate us, right? So while I really appreciate the kinds of exchanges that can happen clinically, I always leave thinking, well, at the end of the day, we're still social creatures, right? There's only so much the clinic can do. So how do you balance that between, you know, being aware that a lot of our problems are socially inculcated, you know, they're shaped out of certain political conditions we're in, and the fact that a lot of clinical discourse might not address that, right?
So
how do you face that crossroad?
Well, I see that existential psychology is very much an approach that's socially embedded, you know, because, well, I think Martin Heidegger has said that our existence is a being in the world, meaning that our existence cannot be separated from this context. Wherever we go, we bring this context with us. And I do recognize that. And we call that sometimes certain givens in life, you know, life, death, meaning, isolations. These are some of the givens in life that we have no control over. You know, like it or not, we're going to die. We look for meaning. And we didn't choose even to be born like Martin Heidegger, so we were thrown into this world. And
thrownness, I like that term.
Thrownness, And similarly, you and I have been thrown into this land of Malaysia, and we have certain situations that we need to live with. So I guess the question is, then what do we do with these givens in life? We can't change it. And understandably, they are sometimes depressing. And so the attitudes towards suffering, which is what Viktor Frankl was talking about, is something that can maybe address this. So recognize that, we have all the right to feel depressed, distressed, upset, angry about the situation. And then now, what's next?
I think that's a very important skill to have, to make room for ugly feelings without feeling ugly.
Exactly.
You know, because this resonates with the quote you read, that there is a problem too in wanting to be cheerful all the time, you know, because the human condition is so multifaceted.
You know,
cheerfulness, pleasure is just one side of the spectrum, right? And a lot of life is dealing with disappointment and frustration, and that's how you grow too. But, you know, the way that we're socialized, you know, we're often being told that feeling sad and feeling down, feeling mournful, grieving is something bad, and you have to kind of get out of it as soon as possible.
And they call it negative emotion.
So I think sometimes, given that the environment is collapsing and, you know, global warming is basically destroying the earth, you know, being sad is a smart thing to do.
You know, my friend even told me one time, I mean, he's also a psychologist, and he said, I like sad people. And I said, huh? Why? And he said, you guys are honest because you really, you know, see how it is like. And, well, it's not like we encourage people to be sad, but I think that sometimes we are too much into that, let's cheer up, be positive, and let's not be negative. Sometimes we just really need that space to feel the other side of emotions as well, the other spectrum of the emotions as well.
Yeah. And it's sad to me that when we talk about being emotional, right, we've been socialized to just think of being emotional as bursting out or, you know, losing our cool or being completely callous and reckless with our words, you know, and then we hide behind it. Oh, no, I was just being emotional. There's nothing wrong with being emotional. So the range of emotions we are afforded to express publicly is always the worst kind, right? Because we're so contained to hold back our emotions, that when it does come out, it's only the bad stuff.
Exactly. Imagine, you know, a woman sitting in the middle of the street pulling her hairs. And
yeah, yeah. When actually, you know, we think about emotional life and the palette of colors that it entails, right? Yeah. Shows that if we are more welcoming of what it means to really be emotional, it just won't be going crazy, you know? It'll be, you know, welcoming a more complex range of expression, right? But such is the life that we live, it's so inundated with just false promises of constant endless highs and pleasure that the bluer side of who we are, yeah, which makes us human, you know, isn't welcomed. Anyway, I mean, we can go on and on, but we have to wrap up, unfortunately. And I just want to reiterate your work. And if you are curious to know more about the things that Yvonne has talked about, you can look up Lighthouse Psychological Wellbeing Center. Mm-hmm. You have a Facebook page that's just that, right? Lighthouse Psychological Wellbeing Center. You can like it and follow the developments there, or look at www.lighthousepsych.com.
And actually, we have, because last year we had one of the first international existential humanistic psychology conference in Malaysia, so we also set up a page called Existential Humanistic Psychology Malaysia as well. Mm-hmm. So if you just Google that on Facebook, so that's a page where we kind of have updates on some of the things that people who are interested in existential psychology, some of the things that you write, updates on workshops and conferences around this area.
And can you also list the two books you mentioned again, Viktor Frankl's and Irving Yalom's book, just for our listeners?
Yeah, the Viktor Frankl one is called Man's Search for Meaning, and Irving Yalom's is Existential Psychotherapy. And Rollo May also has one, which is also called, I think, Man's Search for Meaning, or something along the line as well. So I think these three are very good introduction to existential psychology.
Yeah, Frankl's book was recommended to me 2 years ago. It's been on my reading list since, you know, so I want to get to it soon, especially, yeah, I've just heard a lot of good things about it, so yeah, I'm looking forward to that. So thank you for the reminder. Once again, thank you also for joining the show, Yvonne.
Thank you for what?
And maybe we can have you on again to talk about other things as well. But for now, you're listening to me, Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, on Night School. Be sure to download our app at the Apple App Store, the Google Play Store, or you can email us, bfmnightschool@gmail.com. Look us up on Facebook. That's BFM Night School. Just type that in the search space and you'll find the page too. This is BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.